This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, Roseanne Barr has reached the denial stage in her reaction to losing her show yesterday. Just a little over a half hour ago, Barr tweeted, quote, "I am not a racist. I never was, and I never will be. One stupid joke in a lifetime of fighting for civil rights for all minorities against network studios at the expense of my nervous system family wealth will never be taken from me," end quote. Fact check. Over the course of her lifetime, there's been more than one such joke. Remember the time Barr called the Boston Marathon bombing a false flag operation designed to remove the Second Amendment? That was November 2013. Meanwhile, at the White House today, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said no one's defending Barr's racist tweets. True, because President Donald Trump instead earlier today tweeted asking for an apology from Disney President Bob Iger, saying, quote, "Gee, he never called President Donald J. Trump to apologize for the horrible statements made and said about me on ABC. Maybe I just didn't get the call," end quote. Oh, and Sanofi US, makers of Ambien, said today, quote, that racism is not a known side effect of its drug, contrary to what Barr claimed yesterday. That is the roundup, and I know it'll probably be out of date by the time our show re-airs at 10 o'clock tonight, but hey, let's dive in anyway. And joining me now to wrestle with the second-day ramifications of ABC's decision to cancel Roseanne Barr's show is Catherine Van Arendonk from Morristown, New Jersey. She is a contributing writer at Vulture. Catherine, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Renee, good to have you back.
Good to be back, Meghna.
Okay, so I haven't talked to you, Renee, since all this happened just yesterday. But what was your first reaction when ABC pulled the plug on Barr's show?
Well, I thought it was they did the right thing, certainly. What I found a little disconcerting was how ABC officials were getting all this praise in social media, given the fact that they were the people who put her on in the first place. And it just made me feel like, you know, it was somehow we're supposed to praise people for putting out a fire that they started. So, you know, I don't know that they really had a choice, but I think that they were reacting to the backlash that was pretty instant when people saw that tweet, and less the tweet itself.
I mean, did they start the fire, or they simply knew that it was always burning there on social media and just went ahead and put the show on the air anyway?
I think they liked the fact that, you know, they could get controversy with Roseanne, and controversy can translate into ratings. And they knew. I mean, CNN said earlier today that there were, you know, three or four other occasions when her tweets presented problems for ABC, but they still kept her on. So, you know, it's always important to reiterate that this was not a one-off. This was not one racist tweet. This was the latest racist tweet.
Right. So, Catherine, to that point, tell me a little bit more about what you think, because, I mean, ABC's statement yesterday said that Roseanne's tweet did not comport with their values as a company. But to Renee's point, I mean, it wasn't the first time she's done something like this. So what was different, if anything, about what Barr tweeted yesterday?
Yeah, Renee's exactly right. There is nothing at all different about what Roseanne Barr tweeted yesterday. She has been tweeting equally racist and damaging conspiracy theories also for the entire run of the show and before. ABC knew exactly what they were getting when they put her on the air. What changed is that slowly they started to feel like there was enough backlash to who Barr was, and potentially to some other problems that the network, some other issues that the network has had with not airing, for instance, a Black-ish episode that was about kneeling and NFL protests. And so that has played into their calculus, and I think at some point finally they decided that enough was enough.
Yeah. You know, I am seeing here that I'm just trying to be sure I find the right thing. Well, you know, it's all going by so fast. Forget it. I'm not even going to try to keep up with it. Renee, so tell me a little bit more. I mean, what I want to understand or try to figure out, I guess, is that if the backlash was, should ABC have done something sooner? I mean, I guess what you were saying earlier is that you don't think they ever should have put the show on the air to begin with.
Well, exactly. It's not a matter of taking it off now. It's the question of why it was on to begin with. You know, back in 2013, when she was making, sort of spreading those conspiracy theories about the Boston Marathon bombing, she also called UN Ambassador Susan Rice an ape. Mm-hmm. Now, that's exactly what she called Valerie Jarrett in the last few days, and there was a bigger reaction. ABC knew this. They knew exactly who they were getting, and to them it was worth the risk. And even if it meant that there would be the occasional racist tweet or conspiracy theory to contend with, they were in it for the ratings. So, you know, again, I don't want to give ABC – ABC should have taken the show off – but the question is, should the show have ever been on to begin with?
Yeah. So, Catherine, the thing that I was looking for, and Renee, sorry, because I was like just in the middle of trying to find my notes here. But Matthew Gilbert in The Globe today pointed out that it was just back in March of this year, I guess, when Ben Sherwood, president of Disney ABC Television Group, told The New York Times, "You can't control Roseanne Barr. Many who have tried failed. She's the one and only." So that speaks to Renee's point. I mean, they fully knew that there was this toxic stew going on in Roseanne Barr's social media life. So why did they persist to the point where, you know, they were waiting for the pushback to get as big as it did?
Yeah, I think I can understand, although I completely agree that given Roseanne's totally demonstrable racism, they should not have put the show on the air in the first place. I can understand the appeal and the desire to put on a revival of the original Roseanne if you could also have had the original Roseanne Barr before she had access to Twitter and before these were parts of her personality. I think it is interesting to see that it has in this sort of taken this long for the tide to turn against it, but it has seemed as though this were going to happen to the show anyhow. It lost one of its major creative forces, Whitney Cummings, one of the people who was really behind bringing it back. She announced last week that she was going to be leaving and was not going to be involved in producing the show anymore. And Wanda Sykes obviously tweeted before it was canceled yesterday that she was no longer going to be a consulting producer on it either. So it does feel like ABC was making a decision, but they were probably canceling a show that was going to be very creatively fraught anyhow.
Yeah. Renee, what do you think about that? Because that's something that we at Radio Boston here have been kind of talking about all day, that, you know, it's hard to remember in the midst of this current maelstrom, but the original Roseanne show from all those many years ago was really a brave voice and truly a breakthrough program back then. And it seems as if I'm seeing reports here that even those original nine seasons now have been pulled from syndication. So is that justified?
You know, I think right now Roseanne Barr is completely toxic and nobody wants to be associated with her, whether it was with the reboot or the original show. You know, the original Roseanne was a bright spot for a lot of people. It spoke very directly into their lives. I think to some degree that's what ABC wanted, but they also wanted this new Roseanne Barr grafted onto Roseanne Connor, you know, with, you know, more radical, more right-wing views, and because they felt that they were trying to make a show for a particular audience. You know, which is offensive in and of itself. I didn't know that TV shows needed to be made for people to support people's political views.
Well, so I'm looking here at an opinion piece posted on Fox News today, and the headline is that ABC doesn't hate Roseanne, the network hates her viewers. And Todd Starnes here is making the argument, why pull the plug on the show entirely? I mean, if ABC owns the content of the series, why not just write Roseanne out of it? That by canceling the show in its entirety, they are denying her all the people who, you know, whether or not they were fans of her, but people who were fans of the show, an opportunity to watch something they loved.
Yeah, there are going to be plenty of things for people who are Trump fans to watch come in the fall. Fox has picked up Last Man Standing, which is a revival of a show where Tim Allen plays a very explicit Trump supporter. He talks about it constantly in that original series. I am sure it will be that way again. There is also already some rumbling that there may be a new fall show or sometime next year with the whole cast of Roseanne except for Roseanne. Obviously there's no way to know what that show is going to be yet, but I am not at all worried that there's going to be a dearth of things for Trump viewers to watch and see their views reflected. The question is, you know, does it have to be Roseanne? Obviously I'm glad that it's not going to be.
Yeah. Renee, what do you think about that?
I mean, I think if the feeling is that you need more economic diversity on TV among the TV characters, then you have a show like the reboot of One Day at a Time on Netflix, which has a Latino family. You know, very much a working class family. You know, these shows do exist, and there's a way to have these shows on without people attached to them who are offending, you know, who are saying racist and incendiary things because that's who they are. And again, that's part of what they wanted on the show, because that's who Roseanne is playing on the show somewhat. She can't say on the show what she said in her tweets. But, you know, when you join the character and the actor that closely, you can't really have one without the other.
Hmm. Catherine, I'm curious what you think about this. I mean, so Channing Dungey is the president of ABC Entertainment. She's the one who made who put out the statement yesterday that they were going to cancel, that they canceled Roseanne Barr's show. Or the Roseanne show. I mean, she's a woman of color. Mm-hmm. Do you think that ABC would have made this decision without Channing Dungey at the helm?
You know, I can't say. I don't want to speculate about what her feeling has been for the past several years about watching what's been going on with ABC programming. She was also at the helm when they greenlit the show. I mean, famously, mm-hmm. the morning after the election, ABC had a meeting of its executives where they talked about how they could make new shows that would be more directly appealing to a Trump voter. They used a different, they called it Middle America, but that's sort of what they meant. And Dungey was involved at that point as well. So, you know, I'm not sure.
Well, back in March, she told the New York Times, this is Channing Dungey telling the Times, we had spent a lot of time looking for diverse voices in terms of people of color and people from different religions and even people with different perspectives on gender, but we had not been thinking nearly enough about economic diversity and some of the other cultural divisions within our own country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. On the other hand, you know, they do have a show. They have Speechless. They have Fresh Off the Boat. They have some other shows that are about families that are not wealthy families, that do not live in coastal urban areas. And there are other shows on network TV that represent different perspectives, different economic levels as well. One of my favorites is NBC's Superstore, which is about a bunch of employees who work at a fictional version of like a Walmart. So they do exist, but I can completely understand this sense that, you know, we need to expand what network programming looks like so that it doesn't just look like people who live in New York.
Renee Graham, last question goes to you. I mean, how firm should networks be in their decision to cancel or rebuke, you know, actors, people, voices that work with them? And because I'm thinking, again, this is the pushback from some of Roseanne Barr's supporters is, you know, Joy Reid is still on MSNBC. Joy Behar hasn't been, you know, taken off the air. They're seeing what they believe is a double standard, that they might abhor what Roseanne Barr said, but she gets her show canceled, whereas other people get to stay on the air.
I think every case is different. I think with Roseanne, it's the cumulative effect that this was not a one-off. Perhaps if she had said this and, you know, in sort of anger or whatever her mood might have been, and it was the only indication that these were her feelings, you know, she might have survived this. Maybe. Social media isn't, you know, social media is kind of built to grind people down when something like this happens. But because she has a history of this, I just think ABC got to a point where they felt like they simply couldn't take the chance of a boycott and advertisers and all the things that come into play when you have a television show on. So, you know, yeah, I suppose if, you know, there had been enough of an upcry or an outcry at MSNBC about Joy Reid's homophobic comments that she made in a blog years ago, then perhaps MSNBC might have had to react differently. But, you know, we have what we have with Roseanne. And again, I defy anyone to argue that it's more important to have her on the show than to take a stand against what she said.
Well, Renee Graham is columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Renee, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And Catherine Van Arendonk, contributing writer on television at Vulture, speaking to us from Morristown, New Jersey. Catherine, it was great to have you. Thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, let's visit a doctor's office now for a serious and difficult discussion that starts off like a regular medical checkup. Dr. Rebecca Lee pauses for a minute and holds her patient's gaze.
Today, Stacey, I wanted to take a minute to kind of hit the pause button and see where you're at, what you are thinking about your illness, and what your goals are.
Goals for the last stage of life. This patient is not yet at that stage, but she does have a serious illness, and Dr. Lee wants to document her patient's preferences before there's a crisis moment in an emergency room or an ICU.
You know, I like to do that when folks are actually feeling well. Do you feel comfortable with that?
Yeah.
Now, such conversations with a primary care doctor are rare. Planning for the end of life ahead of time is part of a North Shore pilot project designed to help patients spend their last days the way they want, while also saving millions of dollars in medical expenses. WBUR's Martha Biebinger picks up the conversation in Dr. Lee's exam room in Danvers.
Stacy Regal O'Hare, 52, inherited a rare disease called von Hippel-Lindau syndrome that can produce tumors, benign and cancerous, all over the body.
It can be dormant or it can be on fire, and right now I'm kind of in between.
But Regal O'Hare is having trouble with some daily activities.
I need help with a lot of physical stuff. I can't really cook anymore, because I keep burning myself.
Regal O'Hare has lost feeling in her hands. A finger might slip off a potholder onto a hot skillet, and Regal O'Hare won't notice it until she sees the skin blister. Dr. Lee offers a box of tissues.
You're amazing.
Thanks.
Dr. Lee glances down at questions on a cue card she received during a recent training for primary care physicians about how to have these difficult conversations with patients.
If you're... health situation were to get worse, what are your goals? What would be your wishes around that?
I would not want to be non-function. Like, I don't even know how to express it. Like, I don't want to be on a vent and just hear.
Vent as in ventilator, if Regal O'Hare becomes unable to breathe on her own. The conversation continues for another 20 minutes. Dr. Lee takes notes that anyone who checks the medical record will see. Helping patients with a serious illness plan ahead is one element of a grant-funded partnership between the North Shore Physicians Group and Care Dimensions, a nonprofit that offers hospice and palliative care. Regal O'Hare does not need hospice, but Dr. Lee wonders if she'd be interested in palliative care to help, for example, with pain management or nutrition counseling or stress at home.
I think with further investigation.
Yeah.
I would, yes.
That yes means Regal O'Hare will get a call soon from Eileen Fagan, a nurse practitioner who will begin to figure out what Regal O'Hare needs.
Such as handicap parking, more care at home, someone to help with grocery delivery. So it's about restoring the freedom to be comfortable, not think about your illness, and carry on.
Patients who have heart or breathing problems are asked to log vital signs daily on a tablet-style device. A nurse reviews the numbers, looking for early warnings. Susan Lysett-Hurley is the project's program director.
If their weight is going up, that means they're probably holding fluid. Are they now also having trouble breathing? And putting that all together, they can make a call to the primary care and maybe adjust their medications before it gets too late, and then they would need emergency department visit.
And that's where the project is expected to save money. Emergency room visits and readmissions after hospitalizations are both down based on the first few months of data. With those two changes, the $750,000 project grant from the state's Health Policy Commission is expected to save $7.2 million. That nearly tenfold return on investment has big implications. 25% of Medicare dollars are spent during the last year of patients' lives. Dr. Don Berwick is a member of the Health Policy Commission.
The promise here is that if we actually do what matters to people, their lives and their deaths are more under their control, they're better for them, and costs fall.
But Berwick points out a problem. The insurer gets the savings. Even in this case, where patients are part of what's supposed to be an innovative healthcare spending model called an ACO, there's no way for North Shore doctors and nurses to use money they did not spend to sustain the project.
So we're going to have to think hard about the American healthcare payment system to allow programs like this to really thrive.
How to sustain projects like this one is a debate unfolding across the country. This program runs through November.
That report from WBUR's Martha Biebinger. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.